On today's episode of Higher Learning, we're joined by Valentina Gissett, the Chief People Officer at Garner Health. Valentina has a really accomplished career and has so much to say on so many different subjects. We talked about everything from first principles thinking, working at Bridgewater, employee experience, and how you develop people on your team. Valentina has such great opinions. I know you're going to love this conversation as much as I did. Can't wait for you to listen. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid, and today we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by somebody I've known for quite a bit of time, and I'm very excited to have this conversation, Valentina Gissett, the Chief People Officer at Garner Health. Valentina, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Oz. How are you?
I'm good. Like, now listen, I don't want to overhype the pod before we even get started, but I've always enjoyed our conversations. You've always got opinionated takes like I do. We've always had good back and forth conversation. You worked and done some amazing things throughout your career. So I'm just really excited to dive in. You ready?
I'm ready. I'm excited to be here.
All right. I'm happy to have you here too. So let's start here, because since we last talked, you took on a new role, Chief People Officer at Garner Health. And as I did some research, I realized this is one of the fastest growing health tech companies that's out there. I think I know what drew you to it, but I want to hear it straight from you. What's the vision? What got you excited about taking such a big role at such a exciting and high growth company?
Yeah. So, you know, Garner is on an audacious journey to transform the healthcare economy. They're basically, you know, as you may know, healthcare costs in the U.S. keep going up and up and up, and healthcare outcomes keep going down and down and down. And so it is among the most messed up things in the world, besides perhaps the world itself. And so was very compelled to that mission, to draw to that mission. And Garner has a very unique approach in that our CEO is a world-class data scientist. And so has taken a really novel approach to understanding which doctors actually perform curative procedures and actually heal patients versus which doctors, which is more common, tend to perform more harmful or useless procedures, leaving patients out of office and sick for longer. So what Garner does is both use this incredibly novel approach where we've categorized something like 80% of the claims data in the US for the past 8 years, analyze that to result in our doctor rankings. When somebody goes to see a Garner top doctor, they actually also get reimbursed by Garner because we're also an HRA. And so the result is, you know, as we know, the entire healthcare system is by and large funded by employers. So what happens is when the employers have the Garner add-on to their insurance, employees get healthy faster. They come back to work faster. Employers save money on health premiums. Employees save money, and the best doctors get more business. So we end up creating a virtuous cycle, and that virtuous cycle saves the employers quite a bit of money per employee per month.
Well, see, as an employer who's been doing this for 13, 14 years, I know very well those costs, and that's something that we take very seriously here, and we've tried to subsidize as much as we can as the company's grown, because I agree with you, healthcare is a big issue in our country, and I admire anybody that wants to take it on. I think the fact that it's so fragmented and that there's so many hands in the pie is a big reason why it is the way it is and it's as costly as it is. And so I love what Garner's trying to do, from bringing some of those things together, trying to reduce costs for the employers and at the employee level. And ultimately, like you said, leads to better health outcomes, more productivity, all that good stuff. And there's just so much exciting things going on in the way of biotechnology and healthcare and longevity in general, that this is something that is really important, and it's something that's, you know, for like you said, very broken. So I think that's awesome. Now I understand why that drew you in. And it's been everything you hoped and more since you got there, or?
Everything I hoped and more. You know, Garner has an incredibly audacious mission, like I said. And our CEO and I share a philosophy that if you have an incredibly audacious mission, you have an obligation to find the most talented people that you can, point them at that problem, you know, set them up for success by like making their expectations very clear, but then give them and ask of them real honesty and accountability. And when we do that consistently throughout the org, we have a culture in which we have the most incredibly talented people consistently doing the best work of their lives, which is amazing. And that part has been really, really fun for me.
So when you say real honesty, said another way, could we say radical transparency? Is that Is that
radical transparency? Is a little different. We are very transparent. I would say closer to radical candor. So we are very transparent, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to do radical candor well, which means we actually care about the care personally access, not just the challenge directly access. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but radical candor, while an amazing idea, an amazing book, can be misapplied and is being misapplied by most companies who claim to use it.
Sure. I like to say this is that radical candor, understanding what Kim Scott's trying to say in that book is really important because it's not just being candid. It's about approach, tone, timing, understanding your audience intention. You know, sometimes like we have these people who are, you know, hey, I'm really radically candid and I'm telling it like it is. And it's like, actually, you're just an asshole. You're not putting much thought into what you're doing. And you're actually being way more derelict than you are being somebody that's actually helping others. So that's really, really an important distinction that you made. And I got to be honest, I was going for a segue there. You know where I'm going with this. I want to talk about your previous experience. I'll tell a quick story. I was on a plane, I don't know, 2016, reading this big book I had just bought. Never heard of this guy, Ray Dalio. But somebody had said you should check out this book, Principles. So I started reading it. And I had a highlighter like I like to do when I'm reading, and I'm just highlighting like half the book. I'm like, I love this, I love this, I love this. And it became kind of like a Bible for me. And I'm like, did this guy write this book for me? Like the way he lives his life, the way he runs his company, these are all the things that either I'm trying to do or I'm aspiring to do. And it was just really exciting. It kind of felt like somebody was in my head. Come to find out that this guy's hugely successful. There's a lot of people who think this way. And so I've been fascinated with Bridgewater since. And what's amazing is that I've met a lot of people since then who worked at Bridgewater in a ton of different capacities. Some people had great things to say. Some people had not great things to say. I kind of started to find out that the way that that culture exists in that book and the way that it's described, sometimes the application of that can be a lot different and it can feel a lot different. And sometimes it can be even a little bit extreme. And then I read a book called The Fund, which gave a completely different perspective. So I'm still fascinated by Bridgewater, obviously really successful company. Ray's obviously really successful at what he does, but I'm always fascinated in talking to people who've worked there. And so you did work at Bridgewater and it's notorious for its culture. I'm just interested, based on all those things that I told you about, you know, reading the Principles book, meeting people, the fund, what can you tell us? Can you separate kind of myth and legend from reality as somebody that worked there and spent time in your career there?
Yeah, I would love to try. So look, I think Principles as a book is incredible. And, you know, many people have the same reaction that you do when reading it, which is like, I'm just like, I'm discovering an absolute truth. I'm reading an absolute truth. There is that to it, almost in the same way that the Communist Manifesto has that to it. Like, it makes a lot of sense if you just read the book, but in application, it gets tricky. And I know that's a wild analogy to make, but the truth is, like, there were more people at Bridgewater living by the principles in a pure of heart way than I think I've seen in any culture anywhere. However, living by the principles does require you to check your ego at the door and like accept the fact that people are going to walk around and tell you what they think your conceptual ceiling is. And that's far from for everyone. And it requires us to be like almost not human to fully be able to embrace all aspects of that culture in a truly egoless way. And so that's hard. And so I think that's where you're seeing, like, that's the rub, is that, like, yeah, this actually is like this beautiful absolute truth. And in places where it's implemented really purely in the company, in pockets, it worked beautifully. And like those of us who liked that culture found it very addictive. But it requires you to be almost, like I said, leave your humanity at the door. And therein lies the rub.
Mm. Karl Marx reference. Great answer. I love everything you did there. Absolutely amazing. So here's what I'd ask you. How did that company set you up for being able to walk into any other environment going forward? Or how has it helped you as you've gone to other places in your career? Did it kind of like lower your eye level a little bit of like, I've been at Bridgewater, so I can handle pretty much anything? Or was it, you know, how did it help you as you go forward?
Yeah, it does a couple of things. So deculturating from Bridgewater is no small feat, because you are in the habit of going around telling everyone exactly what you think about them at the root level all the time. So when I showed up at Chewy and started trying to do that. I'm like, no, no, no. You can't talk to people that way here. You can't tell them that they're illogical. So there is a deculturation thing that I had to go through and that we all have to go through. And the other piece is it does make every other workplace seem a little bit easier by comparison, because it is very intense and the bar is very high. But you also get used to, like, everybody's excellent. Everybody's excellent. And when they're not excellent, you can be like, you're not excellent, and here's why, and let me help you become excellent. And so in almost any other environment, which is one of the things I love so much about Garner and the incredibly high talent bar we have, you start to miss that.
Yeah. All right. So listen, we're going to assume that you've listened to, I don't know, dozens of the Higher Learning podcasts previously, but you're at least taking part in this right now. So in the spirit of radical transparency, I need some feedback. How am I doing as an interviewer? How am I doing as a host? How can I improve?
Let's see. I think that you have great energy and are a very positive host. I think you could be asking me some more incisive follow-up questions right now.
Whoa, that's good. All right, now I have something to prove here. Throw out the script. We are ready to go. You know what? I'm going to show you what I can do. You know what? I'm here for that. I love that. Thank you for the feedback. That's the best answer I can give you. Thank you for the feedback.
All right. It's always a gift. Right.
It is a gift. All right. Culture. Important to you. Important to me. I have to imagine what you went through stuck with you. But what about when you're a CPO at a company? Because like you said, deculturating a little bit from Bridgewater and getting into a company where you're really set the tone on what the culture is. You said that Garner's got a high talent bar. What are you going and doing and trying to set that vision from a culture perspective? You know, taking not just Bridgewater, but Chewy and some of the other experience you've had. Like, are you coming in there to build something new, build on top of what they already had, support and maintain? Like, help me understand in a chief people officer role how you come in and kind of assess the culture and put your fingerprints all over it.
Absolutely. So institutionalizing culture is a real passion of mine. And I do think it comes from that time at Bridgewater. Like, I don't think if you're at all a thoughtful person, you don't participate in that particular kind of, you know, unique culture without coming out of it with some real thoughts of what do I want to take? What do I want to leave? Like, what just happened to me? And like, do I want to replicate it in my own business? That type of thing. A big part of coming into, for example, a company like Garner, my process in even choosing a company is, are the CEO and I by and large aligned on A, the culture that we enjoy and would thrive in, and B, the culture that makes sense to move this company forward. And so a big part of my decision to join Garner is that the CEO and I did have deep alignment on that, like the radical candor piece, the high bar for excellence. Like, these are the things that embody the cultures that we want to be a part of and that we believe result in true high performance. So basically what I do is I came in, the first thing I did was I look at the values and then I look at like what's on the page and what's happening in practice. And then I say, is what's on the page what we want to be happening? And if the answer is no, then we fix it. So that's the first thing we did, is we rewrote the values to be what is the culture that we actually want now. Then we compare that to what's happening in practice. And how do we do that? We do leader interviews, engagement surveys, all of those types of things, data gathering to understand, is the culture that we have the culture that we want? And what we found, like in this particular case, was it was uneven. And so for me, the process of institutionalizing culture is really twofold. The most important part of institutionalizing culture, I think, is the apprenticeship model. The apprenticeship model is basically leaders lead through the culture to their own visible betterment. They're better leaders as a result of leading through the culture. And everybody looks around and they see that and they say, I want to be better in that way. And then leaders take every opportunity to teach. So one of the things I'm doing is pouring very deeply into our entire leadership bench of, okay, now we have these new values. What does it mean to lead through these values? What does courageous communication mean in practice in Garner? So that's one huge pillar, is the apprenticeship piece. The second piece is what I do in my function, in the people function, that in making sure that everything we build uses our cultural direction as part of our North Star. I can't tell you how many companies I've consulted with where they're actually working against their culture. So for example, they'll tell me, we really want a culture of collaboration. We have this value of collaboration, but it's not working. And I'll say, okay, show me your performance review process. And lo and behold, the performance review process is totally about individual delivery. And so you're actually building mechanisms that are at odds with your culture. And so keeping that North Star and making sure that everything I build pushes the culture forward instead of diluting it, those are the two biggest kind of vectors for institutionalizing culture.
Okay. I got a couple questions, follow-up questions. So the first one is going through the interview process, knowing what the CEO is telling you in about the culture and what you're going to be walking into, good, bad, or different, whatever it is. How do you go out through the interview process and validate that and know? Is it through other people you're interviewing with? Do you do any research online? Do you ask, you know, very difficult follow-up questions? Like, because a lot of people like love what they hear in the interview process and they show up and they're like, oh, this is actually very much not what it is. So you gave a lot of instruction on what to do once you get in there and making sure that the values are not just aspirational. But how do you know what's what during an interview process when you're evaluating a company to join?
That's a great question. And the truth is, like, particularly as a CPO, but really in any role, you should be interviewing the CEO as much as they're interviewing you, because your success really depends on your manager. And the CPO-CEO relationship, like my whole ability to do my job depends on alignment with Nick, my CEO. So I do a few things. One, I do ask very hard questions during the interview process from the very beginning. Like, I don't want to waste people's time. I'm pretty intense. I'm pretty direct. Like, if that's not what people want, then we should know early on. And then another thing that I do is I make sure as soon as I have enough information, I put forward, this is what I think, at least at a high level, you need. Here's what I would break. Here's what I would build. Here's the funding that I would need. And this is a lot of places where you find, you know, a lot of CEOs, most CEOs, I would say, talk the talk now about culture being important and the people function being strategic and not a service provider. But when you actually say, like, here's what I think is wrong with your culture. Here's what the resources that I would need to change it. Here are the five things that I would need to break. Like, I would need to break apart your performance review process. It's countercultural. That's the point at which you can see whether people are actually going to walk the talk.
I like that. That's a good follow-up. That's a good answer. And you're right. You're going to put them in a difficult position to establish norms, things the way they've been, see how open they are. And then you're going to get a real idea of what you can do to actually impact and influence. So I love that. Next question for me is, I see you're working from home. I see Think Again by Adam Grant. It's a great book. I think I see principles back there too. Is it remote? Is it hybrid? What is Garner's kind of policy on being in office? And then my follow-up is how does that not impact your ability to really influence and change the culture when we know being in person will at least give you some insights that you might not get? So I'm just interested in what that experience has been like.
Yeah, so we are hybrid. There is a New York hub and 90% of the company is remote. We spend a fair amount of time in person together for a remote company of our size. But for sure, no one has solved, like, how do we do culture as well in remote and hybrid as in person? And I also have not solved it, but I plan to. I think the main thing is making sure that, again, coming back to leaders, making sure that leaders understand the difference between leading hybrid versus remote versus in-person teams and the needs of those employees, and are mindful of them. So, for example, like, we have a strong feedback culture. If Nick gives someone really strong feedback in the office and they walk away feeling, wow, I guess I kind of messed that up, I hope Nick's okay and, like, not upset with me. And then 5 minutes later, he gives them a smile and, like, you know, pats them on the shoulder as he walks by and says, like, I'm so excited to see what the progress is after that meeting. Everything's fine now. But in a remote environment, that can't happen. And so it's all of those little moments that we try to identify and make sure that we're doing as well in the remote world as you can do in the in-person world, to try to make sure that we're embedding the culture that way.
I love that. See that, Jackie? That's incisive follow-up questions. That's taking feedback and applying it. Gotta love it. All right, let's talk about employee experience. This is something you and I care a lot about. We're passionate about. And let's be real, most companies fuck it up. What do you see happening, right? And why is that? And you have a CEO and Nick that you mentioned a couple different times. What would you advise a CEO who wants to be better about employee experience? Because so many companies are not doing this well. Where do they start? How do they go about it?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, understand your employee population and what their actual needs and wants are. I think it's changing so drastically. We have so many more generations in the workplace than we ever have before. All of those generations have different needs and wants. And we would never create an experience for our customers without some thought, research into what our who our customers are, what they care about, and what they want. It is the same thing for the people function. Like, we are also seeking product market fit with our employee population. And that means understanding who they are, understanding what's important to them, creating an EVP along the dimensions of the things that matter to them, delivering on that, and measuring the success of that through the ultimate output of the employee experience, which is engagement.
And you mentioned earlier that you've done engagement surveys. Do you have a principles, no pun intended, around cadence on that? How often you do that? How long it is? I mean, do you find that there's never enough of that? You constantly want to be collecting that feedback? Are you conservative in terms of how much you roll it out? Is it a long questionnaire? Like, how do you go about and kind of get that assessment? And how do you go about making sure that you're getting genuine answers rather than it being, you know, people checking a box or saying what they think you want to hear?
Yeah. So I'll answer the first question first, which is there's no one size all fits answer for every company. But there's also, I don't believe, such a thing as survey fatigue. I believe there is a thing called lack of action fatigue. And so I think the rate at which you survey should be commensurate with the rate at which you can action the results of those surveys. So if you have like a very large, let's say you're a large company and your leaders have a lot of like pure management time. And so they can spend a lot of time developing action plans and working through results of surveys. You could survey every 2 months and quickly iterate on those actions as long as the actions keep at pace with the surveys. So I think it really depends on how much capacity you have to address what you learn from your people.
That's a really good answer. I like that. And I agree with you. If you're not going to do anything about it, then you're surveying once a year. That's too much. But if you're actually able to action on your employee population and show that you're listening and providing that value, I agree with you. Then there's probably no such thing as survey fatigue. Really good answer. All right, we got to pay the bills here. We like to talk about hiring. You love to talk about hiring. I love to talk about hiring. So let's get into it. If I had to ask you about a core hiring philosophy you have for bringing people onto your team, is there one that comes to mind?
My team? Yes. For my team, I have, I very much like to build a team with a mix of mastery and mobility. That is one of my core hiring philosophies. I think that it is important to have both kind of superstars who want to move really quickly through the organization, and to borrow Kim Scott's term, rock stars who are excellent at their job and stable and want to keep knocking that job out of the park. I've learned that lesson through a history of building organizations comprised slowly of the very, very bright and upwardly mobile. And that can work if you've got space for everyone to constantly be moving up. But in a small startup environment where, you know, I've got a mix of like, I need a lot of L2 recruiters to just keep churning out candidates, we have to have a mix of people who want to move up really quickly through the ranks and people who really just want to love their job and want to do that job.
Yeah. So do you think that that either desire for mobility or being a rock star in kind of a specific role, is that static to an individual or does that change throughout people's careers?
I think it absolutely changes. And I think most people go through periods of like stretch and then assimilate and then stretch and then assimilate. Nobody really just keeps stretching and stretching and stretching and stretching and is able to actually like get better without taking some time to plateau and master the things you just learned.
I love that. What about a memorable interview experience? And I know Bridgewater's famous for some memorable interviews, so you don't have to name any names, of course, but just, do you have any memorable interview experiences? Maybe you were interviewing or someone you were interviewing somebody, but I'm just interested. Got any good stories?
Yeah. I have, Bridgewater did have a certain interview called the Bridgewater Culture Interview, and I'm sure they still do, which is a wonderful interview. It goes very, very deep into how reflective are you, how able are you to take feedback. And it requires you to push people pretty hard because you're actually like, I'm a big believer that if you're an outlier in something, behavioral-based interviewing doesn't necessarily work because like when you're using the term feedback, you're actually not, you don't even have the same definition. And so you can't You have to actually test things. You can't just ask questions. So we actually model the culture in real life, or ask someone a question about their previous career. And then I would kind of pick it apart and figure out like mistakes that they made or learnings that they could have as a result, and see if they were receptive to those learnings. And I pretty regularly got, what do I owe you for the therapy session at the end of those interviews, which I quite liked. But it was a really great way. Like, it was a high interface hour where you really got to know the candidate and how they thought about their own growth. And I really appreciate that. Surface level interviews, I find, they just don't give us much.
I love that. What about, do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in interviews? One that you think, you said you've asked tough questions, right? Anything that's your go-to?
I like to ask a question always that people are likely not to have a great answer for, so that I have the ability to push. So my current favorite question, and hopefully no future Garner interviewees of mine are listening, but my
current— They are, but that's okay. We'll give them, you can come up with something else on the fly.
My current favorite question is, tell me about a recent mistake or failure and what you learned. Obviously a very common question, but the what you learned is always, I learned some version of, I learned how to not make the same exact mistake again. It is usually a very surface level learning. And so it gives me the opportunity to model our culture and say, let me push you on that. That sounds like a really shallow learning. Can you dig deeper to cut a wider swath of change in the future? Why? Why did you make that mistake? And what can you learn about yourself as a leader? And actually doing that in an interview setting makes it much harder for somebody to come in and be like, I'm surprised by the feedback culture here, because I've modeled it for them.
Okay. There's something we like to do on this show, and it's called flipping it on you. And then we're going to flip it on me too, and I'm going to answer it. So I want to know a mistake that you've recently made and what you learned from it.
Great. Okay. I had, I'm actually in the process of recuperating from this mistake. But like I said, one of the biggest things that I'm pouring into right now is manager training for our people, both to get them to be real culture champions. And also, like in every startup, we have a ton of battlefield promotions and people who are managing more than they've ever been taught to manage. And I kind of charged off, like, I'm pre-independent. I did my own assessment. I figured out what, you know, I thought that the company needed, and I started designing the curriculum. And then my CEO was like, knock, knock. I care about this. And by the way, I think I have to model it if I'm going to, you know, if we're going to have management training, like I have to really believe in it. And it had been a long time since I'd been in a small company and had somebody like who was really invested, you know, and really wanted to manage down. And I realized that I actually, you know, kind of end-ran him. And so the learning for me is, when somebody actually has the ability and wants to manage you, it is a gift and you should take it, because especially at our level, that doesn't happen very often.
Okay. Good answer. I'm up. Oh, I could pick through a few different mistakes. You do the job I do. I'm managing three different businesses. There's hundreds of people. There's customers. There's a lot that can go wrong. So I'll use this one. So I'm going to take it back. I'm going to be honest. I actually didn't learn the lesson the first time. Maybe I'll learn it the second time. When I first started this company, I had another partner, and I was so turned off by the recruitment industry. There's such a stigma around it. I just thought it was just being done so poorly, which is why I started the company in the first place, that I wanted to actually ignore everything everybody else had always done. And when they were zigging, I wanted to zag. And I wanted to be so innovative in this space that I put blinders on. And I'm like, I don't even want to know. Then my other partner was like, well, should we do the triangle model like Allegis? Should we do XYZ? Should we? And I'm like, nope, don't want to even hear about it. We're rethinking this entire thing. And I think that led to a lot of great innovation. But what I found out around 4 or 5 years into the company is that these companies didn't become billion-dollar companies by being complete idiots. They were doing some things right. And we probably spent a lot of time reinventing the wheel or getting things wrong, that we, if we just would have kept our eyes open and learned from what others were doing, we would have been more successful faster, okay? Fast forward to 2023. Your good friend here is, not 2023, it's 24. That's how messed up I am right now. Fast forward to right now. We are bringing a software to market. And I'm going to be honest with you, I loathe all HR software that's out there right now. It feels like a lot of software people building software things, solving problems that they read about in a book that they don't know how to apply to real day-to-day stuff. I'm in the trenches. We're in the trenches. We know the real problems. And so going to market, last couple of years, been working with our team. We have this super innovative strategy, product-led growth, going directly to the source, not going to the typical buyer, creating the product for this person. They're going to have the money and the budget to do this. And I got to be honest, as I was going through this, I'm thinking, well, I mean, somebody, we can't be, you know, the only people who've ever thought of this. Somebody's had to have done this. But you know what? Forget it. We're revolutionaries. We're changing the way things are done. And as I've gone through this process of sitting with customers and talking to them, I realized that the way things have been done, there's a reason why it works. And when you're bringing something new to market, something that you really believe is a new category, you've got to be same but different. Okay, because if you come and you bring something that people have never seen or never heard from before, the adoption, you're going to get some early adopters who believe, but the vast majority of people are not going to say, this is too unique and too different. I don't even know how to go ask for budget for this. And so I can't do it. So we have to bring something that people understand, like an applicant tracking system, and then build on that and say, but there's so much more. And so that's ultimately a lesson that I'm still going through right now. And I'm testing out with customers and understand the signals. And so what my learning has been is, yes, being innovative is amazing. Yes, putting blinders on and being very devout and passionate about what the way it should be is important. But you know what? If impact is what you want, you're not going to get it if you ignore what everybody else around you has done to success. It's not just about learning from their failures and trying to be completely different. It's about learning from their successes and realizing what can apply to what you're doing so that you can have that broad impact that you want. So my hope is, as much as I love being innovative, as much as I want to be, you know, somebody that's revolutionizing things and doing things in a completely different way, there are things that can be applied that I should be learning from the ones who have done it before. And then maybe I wouldn't be, you know, hitting my head against the wall so much and taking as long as I want to take these things and have the type of success we want to have. So that's my thing. Do you have any follow-ups for me?
That's a good answer. I would, if you gave me that answer in an interview, I probably would not push for a deeper answer because that's a pretty deep answer. I think you got the root cause.
Well, and that, and I probably talk a lot, and we've only got so much time for the interview. So you're like, we got to move on to the next question. Which?
Well, I actually think I'll just say one more thing, which is I think that the problem that you're describing is it's the world that the good CPOs are in right now too, which is like, no, we don't want to use the HR playbook. Like, no, we don't want to take everything that's been done before and replicate it in our organizations. And we want to design from first principles and what's right for a particular company. But at the same time, like, that can result in rookie mistakes. And so like, why not use the insights from the outside world, but come like getting that just right and figuring out like, how do I do my first principles design without making rookie mistakes, without letting what already exists color my first principles thinking is like the ongoing challenge. And so you're not the only one going through it.
Well, I think there's a lot of like, I mean, somebody that studies a lot of entrepreneurs and success and things like that. Like you look at Benioff and you look at Elon Musk and you look at Peter Thiel, these people who are doing crazy, amazing, revolutionary things. But then what you realize is that, yeah, but they're using and leveraging a lot of the models of the past to be successful and then building on top of them. And then when you get to a certain level of critical mass, then all the gloves are off and you can do pretty much anything and define your category and drive it. But to get there, you do have to play by some of the rules that have been put in place and then incrementally, slowly start to change them into your favor. And that's something that they don't talk about in the books. Because you read in the books, you're like, this person came in and they were passionate and they were principled and they were, you know, first principle thinking and all that. But the reality is that there's some level of understanding the rules of the game and then applying them and then bending them to your will over time as you start to get some critical mass.
A huge part of innovation is synthesis, pattern matching, and extrapolation. It's not all just like bursts of creativity and first principles thinking.
Yes. And that is what I've learned. All right, good. We got that covered. All right, now I'm going to ask a different question. What do you do personally to create a great candidate experience, right? So people know what it's like to work with you, to work with Garner. How do you give them a realistic job preview? Is there anything unique and special you do in interviews that will give people an idea of what it's like to work together?
Yeah. So absolutely. We have only one kind of standard resume tell me about a time star type of interview. And the rest of our interviews are actually doing work with the candidates for the most part, working sessions. So we will take something that is applicable to their job and we will get into it with them. you know, like actually replicate the way that we work at Garner, which is like, we are fairly first principles. We are doing something brand new and novel. And so, yeah, we do spend a lot of time at a whiteboard just like, yep. And if we break it this way and break it that way. And so we do our best to replicate that in the interview process. And so we have working sessions where like, we'll work through specific, job-related problems. We do a culture interview, that the one that I just described to you, where I asked that question about a recent mistake that comes out of the culture interview. And it's similar, you know, we give feedback, we seek feedback, we play out the culture a little bit. And then we also do something called a discussion group interview, which is basically, you know, we have a very high talent bar and we want to make sure we hire people who are fluid thinkers. And so we do the old fashioned thing of a really random question, like, should the government fund space travel? Is Walmart good for America? And we'll have a debate and see how framework and structured people are, because we find that framework structured thinkers do best in our environment, because we do tend to break problems down to and interrogate them to their core truths.
I love that. And when I hear people talk about, because I love first principles questions, right? What would happen in this kind of wacky scenario? You're just trying to understand. I actually had a recent executive role that we were hiring for our company, where I purposely put some curveball questions there because I wanted to understand, right? If things go to hell in a handbasket, our industry changes, something, how are you going to approach it? How are you going to think about it? And if you have that level of influence and importance in the company, I need you to be thinking at that level. I can't just have you being a read and react person. So I love that. It has to fit your culture, though, because if it's misplaced and you're just asking those questions to sound intelligent, but that's not actually what your culture of your company is, or you don't actually need that in the role, then it can be a little bit irrelevant or not as good of use.
Irrelevant, yeah. And it's also meant to be a little bit of a self-selection mechanism. You know, some people don't like that. It would be a shame for people to select out for something we don't actually do.
Brilliant. You're absolutely right. All right. What about when you miss somebody? We've all missed on hires before. Can you find a common theme or something that you could look back at and say, I should have done that differently?
I'm always doing that constantly. I think as talent leaders, we're always looking back through the numbers and trying to figure out the themes. Let's see. What's one I'm thinking about now? So we have not historically had like a formal people management component of our interview. We've sort of relied on the hiring managers to do whatever they're going to do in that regard. And as I've said, we've got a little bit of a theme across the company of battlefield managerial promotions, not consistent standards. That's a typical thing of any, you know, fast-growing company. And so one of the things on my mind right now is without it adding more interviews and, you know, extending the candidate experience, how can we really consistently and thoughtfully gauge people management? Because that's a hard thing to interview for.
Yeah, good. I love that answer. All right, last hiring question. If I ask you to tell us about the best hire you've ever made, don't need to name names. I just want to know how you knew and why it ended up being such a great hire. What would you say?
So my lieutenant, my director of people operations, I will name names. I won't name names, but my director of people operations, this is my third company with her and fourth role. When I joined Chewy, she was 2 years out of college and was an HR generalist, and promoted her to HRBP. And what I saw in her was just an incredibly incisive mind. Like, she is very bright. She has an incredible amount of ownership. Like, she felt ownership over the entire tech department at Chewy as an HR generalist with like layers above her, but like, it was her department and she wanted to make it great. So it's the values first and foremost. Like, she deeply valued success and teamwork and like outcomes. It's the raw abilities, just like an incredible thinking package of a conceptual analytical person who, like, basically I could give a problem to, and as 3 years out of college, they would come up with an excellent solution just by being such a like good thinker. So the abilities, and then from a skills perspective, I've just been growing her skills and she's been growing her skills as she moves from role to role. I hired her into the talent management function at Chewy. And then I hired her to join me in my first CPO role. And she came with me into my next CPO role. And she's gone from, you know, being an entry-level employee to being the director of people operations with a sizable team at one of the fastest growing health tech startups in the country in about 4 years.
Did you know what you were getting in the interview? You knew right away?
I think I knew from the beginning. I was like, oh, that she's a star. And I'm going to wrap my arms around her and take her all the way.
Good stuff. All right. What are you working on right now that you're super juiced about? You're super excited about?
I'm super excited about the manager training that I'm developing. It's interesting because both my CEO and I have L&D experience, but neither of us are L&D experts. So we're doing the exact thing that we just talked about, which is building from first principles while trying not to make rookie mistakes. And so I'm designing a very Garner-tailored management training. So, for example, we believe that we can... But not by mandating, but by clarifying how you do some of the easier stuff. Like, how do you write a process? How do you write a performance review? How do you, how do you assess a candidate from when you have a mixed panel? We have basically workflows for all of those things to take the lower level thinking away from the managers. Like, they don't need to think about what process they're going to use. They can if they want to, but they can just use ours. And that way, that leaves them more headspace and time to solve real business problems. So I'm very excited about that, about like standardizing some of our management practices so that our managers can really focus on the things that matter, which is driving business results and creating an incredible employee experience to further drive business results.
It's one of the most impactful things you can do in the company as any type of leader. I took control of our kind of management university last year because it was so important and I wanted to do a better job of cultivating and growing our future leaders. And I think it's been pretty good because we've done a great job of actually bringing in some external people, but also cultivating and developing some of the managers by saying, what does it mean to be a manager here? What does it mean? What does that mean at this company? Because that's actually really important. There's not a static idea of what a manager means. It's what does it mean here and how do you align with that? So I think that's tremendously important work and I can see why you'd be excited about it. We're going to want to hear how it goes. So let us know. All right. You're obviously well read. Tell us, what's the last good book you read?
The last good book I read, I'm rereading something. I'm rereading Radical Candor and I'm reading and I'm blanking on it because I'm listening to it on Audible, but, Kim Scott's new book, what
deal? I've heard of it, but I didn't pick it up yet. Is it good?
It is good.
All good. Last question then. You ready? Yes. This one, I need a strong answer on this one. This is big time. Tell me what advice you'd give 20-year-old Valentina early in her career that you didn't know then, but that you know now.
I would say don't sweat so much where you're going to end up because careers are not linear anymore. Focus not on moving up through the ranks, but on building skills and having fun and doing things you're interested in, and the success will come.
So do you think you were too focused on that early on in your career and that you were really worried about the outcomes and you should have been more focused on kind of the learnings, the people, the opportunities?
Yeah, I was like, a super ambitious young attorney and like wanted to take over the world. And really what I should have been focused on was just learning my craft and other crafts and figuring out exactly how I could be most impactful.
I love that. All right, that is great advice. Valentina, listen, I appreciate the time you spent with us. I always enjoy our conversations. I know we'll have many more going forward, but thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I hope you had a good time.
Same here. It was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right.